The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs. I'm pleased to be here. Kate Doty took on many different projects during her 15 years as writer and editor at the New York Times. Covering presidential campaigns, food, business, and New York City, she finally found a home in the wedding announcements section. Against the backdrop of cutthroat high society figures, politics, and the overwhelming details in the announcement she wrote, Doty's own singular love story began. Her new book is Mergers and Acquisitions, or Everything I Know About Love I Learned on the Wedding Pages. This evening, she'll be joined in conversation with Selena Kopic, a stand-up comedian, writer, author, and creator and voice of @NYTVows, the parody Twitter and Instagram account that really has fun with the New York Times wedding section. And now the screen is all yours.
All right. Thank you so much, Laura. And hello and welcome to everyone, all of our participants who are here. And most importantly, hello and welcome, Kate Doty.
Hello. Hi, how are you? Thank you so much for having me. Thank you so much for being here. I so appreciate it. And hello to everybody. I can't see your faces, but I'm so glad you're here. Thank you so much.
Yes. Yeah. We're here to celebrate Pub Day of your book, which is absolutely wonderful. I feel very lucky. This is the galley. But I feel so lucky that I got my hands on a copy of this a few months back. And, you know, I've just loved reading it. It is such a fantastic read and such a brilliant combining of your love story, your work story, look at the historical traditions surrounding weddings, and also the sort of elitism of the institutions and practices surrounding it. And it's just, it's woven together so beautifully because you learn so much about traditional weddings and the traditions of that and the trappings of all that. But then also you reveal yourself so beautifully and we learn about you and your love story, which is, it's just, I feel like it appeals to so many people who are curious about all different strands and you've woven them together beautifully. So a toast to you and congrats on your wonderful book.
Oh, thank you.
Awesome. So how has your day been? I mean, today is the on sale date. It's such a big day. How's the day been going?
Well, I woke up this morning about 5 o'clock, thinking about like all the things I had to do today. And then I was like, oh, that's today. Like an idiot. It's been, you know, it's been overwhelming in a lot of ways. In some ways I was telling a friend, it's sort of like early childhood, like early labor when you're giving birth, because like the first few hours, I mean, if anybody I'm here has experienced, the first few hours are you're so exciting and you're just waiting and waiting and waiting. And then it's sort of like, oh, there's a long process ahead. So like, this has been super exciting. I've had some fantastic conversations. My living room is filled with flowers and champagne, which is just, you know,
super. I'm doing some of that too on your behalf.
I appreciate that.
I hope you don't mind. Trust me. I have my wits about me.
Even if you don't, we can talk about this. So it's been super exciting. And my husband, of course, has been, more supportive than anybody deserves. So yeah.
I saw him tweeting today. He seems like such a wonderful guy. And mm-hmm. I mean, you know, a huge part of the book. How does he feel about all that? How did that all go over?
If you weren't watching this in a different room with our 6-year-old who needs to be in bed, I would invite him to come tell you himself. But I get to speak for him, so that's fun. He's a real traditionalist. He refused to read the book until the hard copies came, which was about 2 weeks ago, something like that. And he
had
read
the part.
I know. In a I don't know if he should have been that trusting, but he had already read the parts of the book that were really about our story together. And it wasn't like a fact-checking thing. It was more of a, here is how I'm telling our story from my perspective. And also he was good about saying like, well, we actually live there, not here, you know, like that sort of minor stuff. But
yeah.
So he hadn't actually read the book until 2 weeks ago, you know, whenever the hard copies came in. And so he took a day off from work the next day and just read it in the backyard. And, you know, of course I was nervous about many people reading it, you know, it's sort of terrifying, like opening your heart to the world. But obviously the most terrified I am is really how he feels about it. And I know he's in his office watching this rolling his eyes, but it, you know, how he feels about it is the most important to me. And he seems to be cool with it.
That's great.
Yeah.
It's such a fun and wonderful memorialization of your courtship. I mean, when you guys have your kiss on the steps of the New York Public Library, oh, it's just so, it's so New York and so tender and lovely. I mean, it was really, it's fun to watch it all unfold. And I mean, and the fact that you both were working at the Times, was that, mm-hmm. you know, did you find that sort of exciting or did you find that difficult? Because maybe he would prejudge things based on you working in the wedding stuff.
No. No. We had actually met each other via, I mean, it's in the book, but we had met each other via email working on politics stuff. Yes, and so we had had a sort of connection before I joined the weddings desk. You know, he got many earfuls about couples I was writing about, vows comms I was working on. And we have similar senses of humor and similar senses of, well, obviously similar values. So that was really fun to sort of think about that with him. No, it wasn't weird. It was just sort of, I don't know, like when you enter in a relationship and you know, like you're sort of in it for the long haul, it's nice to have obviously common goals and values and whatnot. But we also have the shared, still, even though I'm not really practicing anymore, the shared vision of like journalism place in the world and why it's so important. I mean, he still teaches it at the University of North Carolina. And so we had that shared thing to propel us. And so that was just, it was good to have that foundation. And again, like, even though I'm not really in the game anymore, it has, it's part of our foundation. So,
yeah. And I'm sure such a, cause it's such a unique and difficult career choice, you know, to have deadlines on deadlines on, you know, and news breaking and you're going to New Orleans to cover Katrina and, you know, like what a, it's great to have someone who totally gets that world, you know, and you can connect.
Yes. Yeah. Somebody. Yeah, for sure. For somebody to be like, yep, go do it.
Exactly. Yeah. That's neat. And how does the rest of the family, I mean, is everyone so excited for you and thrilled?
Well, my aunt texted this morning and she said, is it available in stores yet? And I said, as a matter of fact, it is. Yeah. So my cousin, she sent my cousin out to buy two copies. My mother read it. My mom read it a couple of weeks ago. And we can talk more about that later. But she was, you know, she was very into it. There are some things that I got wrong that I'm going to have to fix with a paperback. Like apparently my grandfather didn't have 12 siblings. He had 8, but that's neither here nor there.
Family lore. I know. You know, I know how that, yeah.
I mean, whatever, you know, fine. Okay. Yeah. But I think, you know, by and large, everybody's just been so supportive. And I don't think that, well, I'm positive that they did not really realize how much sharing I was going to do, you know? So I come from a very WASPy sort of, not necessarily reserved family, but just like, you know, sort of what you see is what you get. And to sort of, and to have like 370 pages of emotional, like, this is how I felt about my husband at this point. And just, you know, like how I feel about love in general, I think is probably jarring for some of them, but.
Yeah. It can be revealing, but also, I mean, it never feels yucky or exploitative or too much. You know, I think you share it really beautifully. And
thank you.
Yeah. It's a beautiful book. I really love it. And let's see. So, I mean, I'm not sure if you, shall we talk about the experience of like selling the book? I think people are sometimes curious about that. Although I also would love to talk about just sort of the perception of how people talk about weddings and sort of women's news and that type of thing. I'm not sure.
Whatever you want.
I know. I'm like, which direction shall we go? I wish I could take a poll from the lovely audience. Let's see. I mean, let's talk about, you know, how society views women's news. You know, because I love so much, I was just rereading and I love so much how you sort of mentioned Jonathan Franzen in the book in relation to your husband, you know, not reading that. And I mean, yeah, and I thought it was so fascinating how you talk about sort of the history of this type of news. I mean, did you really love that you fit into the weddings world, or did you sometimes feel like unsure of how, if you were excited to be writing this type of material or?
I think yes and no. I mean, I think all of the things. when I joined the paper, Jill Abramson, who is has long been retired, I suppose, was the Washington bureau chief, and I joined in Washington. And then later on, she became the first and only female editor of the New York Times. And so when I was working in the Washington bureau, I was surrounded by people like Maureen Dowd and Kit Seeley. I mean, these are bylines that I had read, you know, most of my career, or my, you know, ever since I started reading the New York Times, right? Rachel Swarns, Alison Mitchell, these like super powerful women who were like in person, super intimidating. Mm-hmm. And so, but I also saw, even when I was 22, 23 years old, I saw that they had to throw elbows, because if not, it was incredibly difficult for women even then, and you know, certainly less so now. And so I felt like I took a lot from those women, even though they kind of scared the shit out of me in some ways, you know?
Yeah.
And so when I came to New York and started writing wedding announcements, it didn't occur to me that that was sort of women's news at first, in part because the editor of the section was a man and he'd been there for years. Yeah. And so that was, you know, that sort of opened the door for me. But then I never really connected it until later on that, like, oh, this is something that women talk about. Oh, this is something that, like, you know, I remember this when I was a kid, like sitting down and reading the wedding announcements and like the Birmingham News with my mom and talking about them. And like, I have a copy of my parents' wedding announcement in my drawer somewhere. So in terms of like how it fit into women's news, it didn't, I don't know, maybe I was just not really thoughtful about it at age 23, but it didn't occur to me that it was like sort of like the ghetto of women's news until mm-hmm. after the fact.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the times it used to be that, so all of like the main news desks, like Metro, National, Foreign, BizDay, were all on one floor. And then like the soft sections, culture, arts, you know, travel, all of those were up on the fourth floor. And there was this whole thing about like, well, once you move up to the fourth floor, you don't really come back down.
Oh, wow.
Which is sort of like, well, once you get, you know, once you get into the soft news sections, you don't get to go back. Too. And I think that that's largely been eradicated, at least I hope so. But that was sort of a stereotype that people talked about when I was there. Mm-hmm. And I kind of believed it, you know. And I remember talking to, this is in the book, I remember talking to an editor on the national desk. And I said, oh, I said sort of offhandedly, like, oh, I want to be a travel reporter. And she looked at me and said, why? You know, yeah. And sort of walked off, and it hurt my feelings. But by the same token, she was clearly broadcasting me, like, don't go up there. I mean, yeah. I had no chance of being a travel reporter anyway, but anyway, so.
Travel reporting seems like an impossible gig to get, like to get paid to travel. I mean, you know.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah. You have to like be the 52 places person. I mean, God.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah.
But I mean, I agree. I think often, yeah, when you're young, you kind of don't realize the way that chick lit is dismissed as, you know, mm-hmm. unserious, you know, and sort of why it is that way. And yeah, I think that's why, I mean, if a couple of years, or, you know, maybe it was more than a couple of years ago, but when Jonathan Franzen and Jennifer Weiner, I think, had that sort of brawl about that, I found it so sort of compelling to be like, wow, you're right. I think I had internalized a lot of that, unfortunately, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and I love that she's out there like fighting for us all, I guess,
awesome. Yeah, in a totally. Way.
But I mean, you know, I lived in New York. Well, I moved to New York in like 2004, and that was like right in the middle of like the Jonathan Franzen heyday. And also, like, you might remember there was this whole group of like white dudes who kind of ran New York media, and like they would be at the same parties, and like they started up publications and they had all this money because they knew the right people. And so the control is very much in their hands too. And watching that unfold was just really fascinating to me.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and I love too, in sort of to dovetail with that, in chapter 7, you talk so much about like the history of weddings, the sort of creation of the wedding industrial complex. And I found that so fascinating. Just the fact that, you know, until the 1920s, a wedding would be really more of a backyard affair. And I mean, my parents' wedding was a backyard affair, and that was, you know, in the 60s. But were you already interested in that? Or did you do a ton of research on that? And was that fun to research?
You mean as I was writing the book? Oh, yes. I did a ton of research. I mean, you know, obviously I have a lot of lived experience with weddings. And most of my family's weddings, with the exception of my cousin's like $500,000 insane, beautiful, but insane thing, have been like, you go, you know, you get married at the church, like your mom makes your cake, you have like pulled mints at the reception, and then you like, I don't know, go to the Outer Banks for your honeymoon. And it's all lovely. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. But the more I read about the history of weddings, the wedding traditions in general, the more I wanted to really dig into that. And I felt it was a really important facet of the book.
Yeah, I agree. Because I think it's such an on-ramp for a lot of people, and a lot of people who may have sort of been served the Kool-Aid of like, you've got to do this at your wedding and you've got to have chair covers and, you know, you need to nearly bankrupt your family. I mean,
right.
I used to do a lot of stand-up about that and how I'm the youngest of three girls. So my family's been through a whole lot of weddings that my parents have hosted.
Gosh. But
yeah, it's a lot. And I mean, so did you feel like because you are so aware of weddings, you kind of had a lot of decisive taste? You felt like your taste was set for planning yours?
I was real, let me think. I wouldn't say I was a bridezilla. I had very definite ideas. Yes.
That's good.
And as or more important, my mother had very definite ideas about how things should go.
Oh yeah. Like, share with us some examples
So I'm sure she's not watching.
I was like, or we could change topics. Okay.
No, it's fine. And even if she is, I got married in 2010 and I had a very vintagey wedding. Mm-hmm. Let me think how this went. So Michael had sort of like not asked for my hand, but sort of like talked to my parents before the Christmas before and said, this is what I'm planning on doing. I just wanted to let you know. And like, you know, like we're all on board with this. And it was right around that time, my mom had gone to her like best friend from college's daughter's wedding. And she started dropping these hints of like, you know, the Columbia Club would be a great place to get married. And I was like, cool. Not thinking about that right now. You know,
don't jinx it.
Exactly. I was like, this is not a thing. So then of course, after we got engaged, I mean, it was just like off to the races. And, you know, we sort of crafted this very definite vision together. But like 2010 was like, that was when fancy letterpress was coming in. And like, everybody drank their beverages out of mason jars. And you had a signature cocktail. And all of these things. No, I didn't have mason jars, but everything else I had.
Yeah.
And I was talking to somebody else recently and she said she got married like the year before. And she said, you can absolutely look at my wedding and say, oh, I got married in 2009.
Yeah.
You can totally look at my wedding and say, yep, sounds about
it's
right.
Funny. Yeah. Sometimes like even by someone's wedding first dance song, I'm like, I'll tell you what year you got married, you know, like, I mean, or if the bridesmaid dresses were T-length, oh, we're talking early aughts, you know, I mean,
true. So our first dance was to Bruce Springsteen's If I Should Fall Behind. Which is like a lovely song, and I love the song and I like cry every time I hear it. And we had this Irish band play it. We got engaged in Ireland. My husband is of Irish descent, blah, blah, blah. So we hired this local Irish band and it was wonderful, except for the fact that the end of the song actually really goes on for kind of a long time. It's like a 4-minute song. And like a first dance song should be like 2 minutes, like you're done, right?
Yeah,
like
you
like waltz, you like wave, get the pictures taken, that's it. But we kept going around and around. And finally we were like, stop. And I could like see our wonderful family and friends who were there to support us. Like I could see their eyelids kind of going like, you know, like stop. And also my mother had made my dress and it was this beautiful, it was gorgeous, but the skirt had this lace overlay and the lace grew as the evening went on. And so it stretched out. And so by the end of it, I had like this armful of lace that I was like dragging around everywhere I went. And so, you know, we're like Michael is like spinning me around this pavilion and it's gorgeous and it's raining and it's April and the birds are chirping and everybody's happy. And I was like, we have to stop. I can't do this anymore. Stop. Anyway, I'm sure he's watching this and is like, I didn't know that's what you were thinking. But
yes. Bravo that your mom made your wedding dress. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is phenomenal. Oh my gosh. I love it so much. And I mean, and now do you feel like there are any like wedding trends that you're so glad you avoided or things that were pushed on you that you're like, no dice as far as wedding stuff goes?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I should be able to think of it. I mean, the mason jars.
Oh yeah. I mean, there was a moment where, it was like, if you're not having a farm wedding, you're not having a wedding. You know, it was just like a lot of burlap sack accents and mason jars. And you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but it was an era, certainly.
Oh my God. You went to a lot of weddings around that time, didn't you?
I was in a sorority. It's all I did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have credit card debt to prove it. Yeah. Sorry. Continue.
Oh God. Yeah. Oh my God. I mean, there's a part in the book where I said something like, I sold my grandmother's silver to go to a wedding. Yes. And that is 100% true.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, I didn't like it anyway. And I was grateful to have it. But that, you know, for the first 8 years of your life, if you're of a certain economic class, like you just dole out money. And then of course, when it's your turn, you're like, I'm going to have the greatest wedding ever. And then, you know, the mason jar thing, I would say, I mean, our wedding was very expensive to us, but I still didn't feel like I don't know, this might sound obtuse, but we didn't have like the kind of wedding where you can just like almost see the dollar bills just like being thrown around, you know, and it was good. I mean, we had no choice but to avoid that. It's not like we had those dollar bills to light on fire or anything. you know, we didn't do like matching bridesmaids dresses, that sort of thing. We just sort of like, we tried to keep it as low key as possible.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Did you just do like women wear a color? Like you had your friends wear a color and then be with you or no?
I just said like, just wear a pretty dress, you know? Like
I love that. That's
my great. Oldest friend wore, you know, the dress that she wore to her rehearsal dinner. So we just felt like, you know, we wanted to keep it low key, but there are some very definite things. Like we wanted to have like a drunk shuttle because we got married at the top of the mountain and we wanted to make sure that people could get down the mountain.
Yeah.
We wanted to, you know, I think the thing that we really focused on other than like making sure our vows were perfect or as perfect as we could get them was that like everybody was safe. Everybody was cool. Everybody had a good time, you know? So.
Yeah. It sounds like an awesome band, which I feel like is the make or break too.
It was really great.
Yeah, that's so great. I mean, I'm sure too. I think, you know, when you cover enough of them, I would imagine you end up, you know, being like, here's what I don't want to do. Here's what I do want to do. Like it's.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm sure it's such an extension of all the work you had done. And actually, let's go back to that. And then I do want to get to more talking about the book creation. But I mean, I'm so curious, like, you know, in rereading the book, it seems like, I think you try to, I mean, I don't know if you're trying to downplay how many brides and grooms were sort of monstrous or, but I mean, was it, did you find it? It seems like such a challenging job, especially with New York City brides and grooms. Let's be real. I know we're at the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm giving Belly a shout out. But you know, I mean, I think especially New York elite, I mean, can be so insufferable. Like, was that hard to work, to deal with and to bite your tongue?
Yeah. To a certain extent. I mean, it was definitely a lesson for me. I mean, I came from not small town North Carolina, but just in the South, where weddings are a very big deal. But obviously, like the upper economic classes of New York City are like, you know, nothing you could understand unless you have encountered it and swum in it and, you know, had drinks with them.
Yeah.
And so that was a real crash course for me, just even in terms of like how to talk to these people. Lots of like finance bros too. I mean, this was the era of like, do you remember the Goldman Sachs elevator Twitter feed?
Oh, I
like,
loved
like, overheard and like Goldman Sachs. Like it was sort of like the precursor to that, I guess.
Okay.
But it was that era and it was pre-crash, like pre-2008, like there was a little bit of excess going on. Like people were sort of like feeling like they had money to burn.
Yeah.
And so in this milieu of wealthy brides and grooms, like there was a lot of like, you're what, you know, like you do what, and there was certainly a lot of blowing smoke about titles, and also like, I don't know what a vice president of operations at blah blah does, like, so it was even that sort of like having to decipher this and having to ask the questions like, well, what does that mean, and just being talked down to, like, well, of course you should know what my incredibly obscure job in finance is, or like, you know, so there was definitely that, but it was more than that. It was like, so there's a character in the book, Mitzi, who is actually an amalgam of a lot of different women that I wrote about, but all sort of, this is memoir. So, you know, I think we had license to do that. And also the lawyer said I had to do that. So
for safety's sake. And also Mitzi is a perfect catch-all name for that type, you know?
Yes. Yes. Thank you. I felt that was appropriate.
It is perfect.
But these people, you know, they would send their announcements in and they would detail like every Mayflower ancestor they had, every person who was like the first mayor of New Haven or whatever, like the second president of the New York Stock Exchange, all of that stuff that means so much in that area.
Yeah.
It means so much to a certain class of people. But to me, I was like, I don't care. Or it's not that I don't care. Well, no, I really, I don't care. But, and the good thing was the society editor, Ira, in the book was also really good at saying, you should care about this, not that. And so that was really helpful for me in terms of, like, there's this piece in the book about this woman who had gotten her announcement in like 2 weeks after the closing date or whatever. And her grandmother was this like fabulous socialite, was like connected to the Astors. I mean, she was like a gazillionaire, like a big Republican fundraiser. She's a big deal. She was like a grand dame of the old age. And this, and her granddaughter was getting married, and she was actually this really lovely, unassuming, like kindergarten teacher or something like that. And I said, well, this one is really late. And Ira said, we have to do this one. Because he understood where this woman sat in society and the connections that she had and the strings that she could pull. And also just for like, I don't know, straight up like story lineage, you know, like her announcement was in the paper, like her grandmother's announcement was in the paper, like all of her sisters and everybody had been in the paper. So it would stand to reason that her granddaughter, this unassuming kindergarten teacher, of course should have her announcement in the paper.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. And it seemed like Ira, I really appreciated that. I mean, it seemed like he was a sort of savvy about like not burning bridges to that world. And you know, not like kowtowing to them, but you know, making mm-hmm. sure that this is important to them. Cool. You're like, that keeps it relevant. But then B, I really liked how there seemed to be a focus on like service and, you know, like people who kind of did both something interesting and service, you know, which I thought was mm-hmm. really a cool thing. And also you put it in such a neat way of like, you're just trying to learn about people and share people's stories. And yeah, it was interesting to me how it seemed as though like there was one bride who you mentioned who was sort of, she almost couldn't say what she does, you know? And I mean, I find that so like elite New York. I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of rich people.
Because she has so much money that it doesn't matter what she does.
Exactly. You know, and the fact, you know, and I thought that you had such a wonderful sort of non-judgmental way about it where you're like, you know, on the one hand, you're sort of, you know, pointing out it's kind of hilarious that she's like, I don't know, sit on boards and play tennis. What do you want from me? You know, but that's also like, that's kind of enough, you know? I mean, hey, you know, takes all kinds of kinds, as they say, you know?
I mean, you know, hand to God, if I had millions or actually billions, which is what she has at her disposal, would I have a day job? No.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, I would probably be enjoying my life running around. Also, speaking of socioeconomics, I'm muting myself occasionally because I moved to an apartment right close to the highway. So I'm hoping that when the highway is too loud, I don't want it to disrupt. So if it seems weird that I keep muting and unmuting, that's why.
Are you close to the BQE?
I am. Yeah. I know. Yeah. Yeah. My boyfriend and I just moved in together and we found a wonderful 2-bedroom and it gets great sunlight because our backyard is the BQE. So no buildings right there, which, you know, hey, pros and cons, as they say.
Yes. Yes.
did you want to talk at all? And I don't know, and you can say no if you feel that way, but about a realization that you had once you wrote the book about your grandparents' wedding and the timing of that. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, they're dead.
I think this is fascinating. Yeah. Just
like, so yes. So my mother read this book about 2 weeks ago, I guess. It was right before we talked, I think. And she texted me on Sunday morning and she said, I stayed up all night reading it. I laughed, I cried, and the cat's out of the bag. And I said, well, what cat are you talking about? Because frankly, this book lets lots of cats out of the bag. And you know, as far as I'm concerned.
Many cats, many bags. Yeah.
So many. And she said, well, the one about your grandparents. And I said, what are you talking about? So there's a chapter so I am named after my maternal grandmother and those grandparents, my mom's parents, were really, really important to me, like fundamental to me in my childhood. And then they met and married during World War II in New York City. They were both in the Coast Guard. They both were from small towns in the South. Like they moved up and then they met each other at the supply depot where they were both working as Coast Guard somethings. And they got married a year later, moved in together. That was the end of that. Except, so my mom said, well, you know how they always celebrated their anniversary in January? I did not know that because I have zero head for anniversaries and birthdays. Like I actually have to text my brother every year to say, when's mom's birthday? And he's like, you're such an asshole. But anyway. So
it's like, how many years have you had to get this right? Oh,
God. Seriously, like I'm going to be 42 this year. So you think you know. But anyway, but I have like this fundamental block against it. And I said, no. And she said, well, it turns out that, so in the book, I write about their love story, when they got married, blah, blah, blah. And they got married at a church on the in Midtown on the east side called the Little Church Around the Corner. And during World War II, it's beautiful. It's like this cute, you know, it's gorgeous little Anglican church, I think.
And they also filmed an episode of Sex and the City in the exterior. Let's talk about that
they
on the
did.
Inside.
Yeah. They did. And it's got this gorgeous pagoda. I mean, it's just, I used to go there just because it was like a lovely place to sit and be quiet. And It's leafy in the middle of Midtown, you know?
Yeah.
But they have all these records of people who got married there across the war and throughout the 30s and 40s, because the trope was during World War II, if you wanted to get married, and actually after that, if you wanted to get married quickly, the little church around the corner would marry you, which was very appealing to wartime brides and grooms. And the guy, the rector there, this guy Randolph Ray, I think estimated he married thousands of couples over the years. And my grandmother used to tell the story that like they had to sit in the pews and wait online to get married that Saturday because there's so many people trying to get married. And they get married in 1944, like the war, like it was close, the war was close to winding down, you know? So anyway, the wedding certificate in the book says March 4th. They always celebrated their wedding on like January 4th. And I never put two and two together because again, I don't know my grandparents' anniversary is. And my mom started laughing. She's like, well, your grandmother was knocked up when they got married. Which is like, no judgment at all whatsoever. Like, I'm glad she was having some fun. I mean, I hope she was. But they maintained this lie for 64 years until she died. And they always said, like, I mean, I don't know how often people ask for, you know, ask where their wedding license was. They always said that they lost it.
God, brilliant.
But my mom also said that none of the sisters knew except for one, because she had made some, she's one of five girls, and she's the middle child, and it shows. And one of the sisters had made some comment once about like, how stupid could a girl be to get pregnant out of, you know, like, you know, to get, I mean, this was like a long time, you know, whatever. And apparently my grandmother just lit into her and told her the truth and kind of swore her to secrecy. And it never came out until my mother texted everybody at 7 o'clock in the morning a couple of Sundays ago and was like, what?
Family secrets revealed.
Yes.
Wow. That is so, that's, oh my gosh. I find that so fascinating. And yeah, I love, I actually used to be a tour guide on the Sex and the City bus tour in New York City.
Funny.
I know, which is how I know of that church, because yeah, we used to go there because when Samantha was hitting on the guy from there. And I love, that's one thing also I wanted to talk about. I love that you mentioned the episode of Sex and the City where Charlotte's announcement is in the, you know, in the vows section.
And when they Hitler.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know, that was, oh my gosh. But then also, there was another episode when Carrie's getting over Big where they talk about, you know, how everyone in the vows section that day was under the age of 29, which I also thought was so interesting when you talk about one groom who, you know, he thought his bride was 29, but then in the actual announcement, it turns out she's 30 and he's horrified.
Dumbass. I mean,
yeah, honestly, I mean, did you, and I guess it's terrible to generalize, but let's do it. Did you feel like, I mean, did you find that like grooms were more difficult than brides? And what were, in particular, were people more difficult about certain issues like a bride versus a groom?
That's a good question. Generally grooms were more difficult to get a hold of, just because they just
more difficult to get a hold of.
As okay, much,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Unless like one of them had their mother being like, you better do this. They were like, I just don't really care. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say this is like by and large a bridal thing, but it kind of was, or it was like a mother of the bride thing. Like the mother of the bride would like do the announcement and send it all in and all of that. So, yeah. I'm trying to think like guys were definitely more, attentive about their titles, you know, again, because a lot of these guys are finance guys, and like, not to slag on finance guys at all. Like it's actually not what I'm trying to do, but like, it's so competitive and like, these guys, their wedding announcements would be read by the guy who shares the cube next to them or something. Yeah. And so it was, you know, yet one more thing for them to kind of have to worry about. So there was that, you know, and there a lot of guys would be like, well, you know, I'm about to be vice president, but like, you're not right now. So
I mean, that's one thing that always strikes me, you know, and, you know, I've been reading the section since I was 12 and, like, I just find it fascinating how often, you know, the vows will, or, you know, the wedding section will include I mean, I appreciate that it's all got to be totally true and you fact check it like crazy. And they even sometimes will include little factoids that are kind of unnecessary and almost cruel. Like, and I mean, and not necessarily cruel, but like just sort of funny and quirky. I mean, I think when we spoke, we talked about how a few years ago, there was one where the bride and groom, the announcement, you know, the whole thing was that they wanted everyone to put their phones in pouches and really be present for the event.
Right.
And you know, and the wedding sec, which also, it seems like it's such a trickle down from celebrity culture into civilian culture. You know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah. Oh,
and I think that's, that's such a thing, but yeah. And then in the wedding section, they said, you know, and everyone did this except four people.
It just those four people.
Exactly. Those, yeah, it just seemed so like kind of, yeah, like mean to these four people. And I was like, wow, New York Times is really sticking it to those four people, you know?
But it was true. I mean, it is a fact. And it is, I mean, that's one of the funny things about these vows columns and the wedding announcements. Like, like you said, everything is fact checked. Everything that is printed as you know it to be true. I mean, granted, like there are some things that are revealed later, as you know it to be true, are true. And so by that, like, the section has always treated weddings as news because they are, and they're also part of the public record. You know, that's why, I mean, with a very rare exception, as far as I know, they don't take down wedding announcements. Like even if it was like annulled the day after, they don't take them down because it is an event that happened. It is news. Mm-hmm. It is society news. And so, yes, there is it's really funny how you think like, well, this is about somebody's wedding. It's their special day. It's, you know, it becomes part of their mythology, but like to the Times, it's almost like just another news article.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
And treated with that level of journalistic rigor, which I think is awesome, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, did you ever, and you touch on this somewhat about like people who are super evasive or like, did people really lie to you and you had to have some uncomfortable conversations?
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
Ooh, spill the tea.
I mean, there probably were people who lied to me that I don't know about to this day, but people would lie about their titles. People would lie about whether they're actually descended from, I don't know, William Bradford, or I don't know, like that kind of thing. And you would kind of catch them out in it, or you wouldn't necessarily catch them out in it, but for things like Mayflower lineage, like you have to submit some form, like a document that shows that is proof, and as much as you can create proof for that, that you are actually descended from X, Y, or Z who came over and signed the Mayflower Compact and blah, blah, blah. Like me, for example.
Yes. Yeah.
God. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, and they have clubs. Like I used to work with a woman who was in like some sort of a club that was like, we're all Mayflower descendants and we're in a club. And I was like, cool.
I mean, so the dude that I'm descended from, this guy, Edward Doty, first of all, he was an absolute scoundrel, like 100%. Yes. He was a nightmare of a human being. And he also had like 14 kids. So by the time this Mayflower DNA gets to me, like I'm probably related to 200,000 people, and I'm not actually exaggerating. So it's like this whole Mayflower lineage thing, like I can trace my list, you know, all the way back to William Bradford, whatever. So can a lot of other people. They just don't care about it.
Yeah.
You know, and also it's like, it's part of this whole, I don't know, white American establishment that like we like to perpetuate. And it's all based on a lot of mythology that like, and some narratives that really need to be torn down. But anyway.
Oh, completely. I mean, and I think it is nice that, and we'll get to some Q&A in 1 second, but I do think it's nice that, that, I mean, you know, audience Q&A, but I think it is nice that it seems as though the section has evolved over the years. I mean, you know, and I know that like my whole account is mocking, you know, mocking the Mayflower stuff. But, you know, I mean, my mom will talk about, you know, my parents' wedding was in the vows section. And, you know, that used to be back when only there was a picture of the bride and that was it. And you really had to be a society family, you know? Mm-hmm. And I, so like, I mean, every Sunday when I open it, I appreciate, I mean, it's not as diverse as America, but there is some push for some diversity now, you know? And
yes.
Have you seen that happen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's really, it's heartening to me. You know, I really love the way this section is going. I mean, it's never, to my mind, it's never going to be a familiar cross section of what America really looks like. But then like, it's a cross section of one part of a familiar America, mm-hmm. but it is growing more diverse. I mean, did you see the story? Was it last weekend? It wasn't in the vows section. I think it was in Styles, but it was about how like platonic partners are getting married.
Yes.
Which is fascinating.
I know. So, yeah.
You know, like, Can you imagine a wedding announcement of two people who are like, oh, by the way, we're not in love. Like this is a like platonic love story, and it's changing the very romantic nature of marriage. And I think that is so interesting. It opens it up to so many different possibilities and partnerships and like a definition of love. And I think it's super cool. So yes, part of blaming, it has gotten more diverse in part because like the hands on the section have changed, like the paper itself is changing. And I think there's more of a focus and a priority on it. But yeah, I'm excited to see like how it goes. And also like whether the announcements will exist in 10 years. You know, I don't know.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, okay. We should take some, we have wonderful questions from the audience that I would love to dive into. Yeah. These are great. And you know what, let's start with the first one. And I love this. This is from Dylan O'Dunn. and is this someone, you know?
Yes, it is.
Oh, good. Okay. Wonderful.
Well, hi, Delano.
Okay. Oh, Delano. Sorry. Delano. Well, it's a great question. And I think people are very curious about the book writing experience. So Delano asks, when did you know this was a story to tell when you wanted to write this book? Sort of, yeah. Mm.
Well, so I have to give a lot of credit to the formation of the idea to my friend, Jenny Eatley, who I met, gosh, years ago. And she used to be a reporter at the Times. And as soon as I started writing the wedding announcements, I mean, she grew up in New York and she was, you have to write a book about this. You have to write a book about this. And I was like 23 and I was like, I don't know how to do such a thing. And so then it was always this thing that I was like, I'm going to write a book and never did. But then we moved down to North Carolina, almost 4 years ago, exactly. And that was when it's kind of hard to write about a life when you're in the middle of it. And so when we got down here and our lives were very different, I sort of had the perspective and also the comfort of being home, being in a place that I knew. And it sort of gave me that foundation to say like, okay, I can do this now. And also, you know, when I was talking with my agent about what kind of book this would be, she was like, well, you're not a sociologist. You can't write a sociology text. Like, this is not who you are. How are you going to write this? And then she said something that was like, well, what lessons did you learn? And that sort of opened, that sort of like, you know, turned the light bulb on of like, oh, well, actually I learned how to love, you know, and how to decide to commit and how to decide, you know, how to figure out what it is I really wanted. So,
yeah. And that, I mean, I'm sure, you know, from that question, it ended up being all the different, you know, pieces that you weave together. Cause it's not just, here's the tea about working at the Times. And it's not just, hey, I fell in love in New York. And it's, you know, like, it's so many great things. And yeah, and there's such wonderful lessons there. Oh, that's great.
Thank you.
Okay, question from Rachel Gordon. How did you think about writing this story, which is really a series of wonderful stories? Agreed, Rachel. Did you know from the start that you wanted certain themes in certain chapters? For example, did you think about how you would tell the story to a friend? Ooh, great question. Also, Rachel says, congrats on a fabulous book.
Oh, thank you, Rachel. I appreciate that. I mean, a lot of these stories have already been told to many friends, you know, and so, which is good because it was already in my head and it was easy for me just to sort of, it was there for me to spit out. And so, you know, I really did write this book like I was telling the story to a bunch of friends. And that was a really helpful way to think about it and a really smart question to ask. So thank you. In terms of a series of stories, I kind of thought of it as like this is a bit cliche, but I kind of thought of it as like how When Harry Met Sally is built, you know, the movie When Harry Met Sally, it's, you know, each sort of segment of the movie starts off with this couple sitting on a couch holding hands and they're old, they're young, they're middle-aged, whatever. And they start talking about how they met and how they knew that was the right one. And I thought, well, you know, Nora Ephron knew what she was doing. So I'll just follow that pattern. So.
Yes, totally. Yeah, I did. I thought the pacing, the chapters were so brilliantly constructed in that way of like, it kind of leaves you wanting more and then switches gears, but then comes back to it. It was great.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay. Kate Lineberry. She's a great question, Kate. I appreciate this. She also spells Kate the same way you do, Kate. What was the most challenging part of writing the book for you?
That's a good question. Well, one, writing it during a pandemic, I think that was sort of a thing.
Weren't creative while you're trying to get toilet paper?
Yeah. And work full time and like wrangle a child and, you know, like maintain a marriage. Number one, it truly, the pandemic was obviously a thing, but I would also say like I'm a pretty unfiltered person, but it was very difficult to look inward and really be honest about how I felt at a certain period of time, because we all tell lies to ourselves, like, oh no, I'm good. Like, I'm going to get through this, you know, whatever challenge is awaiting us. But like, there are a lot of challenges that faced me as the story happened, you know, in my 20s. A lot of challenges face everybody in their 20s, and facing up to maybe I didn't handle that as well as I could have. But also like facing up to the real anxieties that I had about commitment, wherein at the time I was like, no, I'm good. Which in fact was complete and utter BS. Mm-hmm. Like I was clearly, as the book tells you, like not cool about commitment. Yeah. And so it was like, it was almost therapeutic in a way, like, you know, cheap therapy, digging through and like figuring out how I really felt.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's also part of what's so compelling is you don't work for the wedding section because you're like this, like, you know, sort of wide-eyed, want to get married tomorrow. Like, I found it very powerful that, you know, you're navigating this relationship and you're not sure how you feel and you got to do a getaway to, you know, like, it's, I think it's very relatable. Yeah. It's a fantastic part of it.
Thank you.
And here a question from Margaret Werner. She says, hi, I'm a huge fan of NYT Vows, both the paper and the Instagram account. Thank you, Margaret. I think I recognize you. She says, I go to Amherst College. Oh my gosh, yay. And I actually just wrote a paper on similarity in the vows as a predictor of how long couples stay married. Wow. I know, my gosh. Talk about, yeah, that's some sociological study.
Yeah.
Did you ever follow up with couples after they were profiled in vows? And thank you so much for your talk. But yeah, do they have a section now that is like when you check in with people kind of?
Well, they, for a long time, so Lois Smith Brady who was the woman who created the vows section. She did these things called State of the Union, which is a great title. Yeah. And it was checking in with people. She had profiles in the vows column. And some of them were still in happy marriages. Some of them were sort of like, you know, they're along, they've got three kids and they're sort of along for the ride. And then, but many of them, and the ones that I really liked the best were the ones that were like, nope, we called it 5 years ago. Yeah. Like we're partnered with other people. Like I'm living at the top of a mountain somewhere. And like, everything is, you know, the way I want it to be. And I've always found this really fascinating. In terms of the people I profiled, there's in the last chapter of the book, I sort of tell you what happens with some of these couples that I profiled. And I mean, obviously I'm never going to reveal their names, but I do check in on them occasionally just through some deep Googling and some ProQuesting. I think it's really fascinating. Like I want to know these people's trajectories. I think it's important. I mean, they were characters in a very minor way in my life. And so, but can I read that paper? I would love to read that paper. And what class did you write that for? That's fascinating.
That's really cool. Yeah. I think Margaret, I know. Yeah. Slide into my DMs. I think we DM already, Margaret. So yeah, just let's all be
Please
in touch.
Do.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
That's really neat. Because I know, you know, in the book, there's so many, you know, obviously you use sort of code names, but it must be really interesting to Google these people. And, you know, I mean, cause you've spoken to them, you know, I mean, you spoke to, for example, was it one of the producers of U2?
Mm-hmm.
And was that real? Or was the U2 a code for something else? Or was that?
No, that's real. That's real. Like I really did hear the Edge in the background and I was like,
God, yes.
whatever album that came out in like 2006 that or 2005, like that was the
I know, I'm trying to remember which one it was. That I was such a U2 head when I was younger, and then I kind of
I'll tell you who it was offline.
It pays to be the host of the Q&A. Also, just a reminder from the wonderful people at the Free Library of Philadelphia, in the chat there is a link where books can be purchased. Yeah. So please remember to buy it. Cause it's such and I feel like the timing is so great for it. I mean, you know, May, June, people being vaccinated, it seems like maybe we're back into wedding season.
I hope so. I really do. I mean, cause like so many of these wedding vendors too are like small female owned businesses. Like they support their families. Like it's a portion of the economy that I think a lot of people don't think about unless they're in it, you know, but like, this is a multi-billion-dollar industry. So like, let's get it going. I want to go to some weddings. I don't know anybody getting married anymore. I'm too old, but I know people getting divorced.
I do think that the State of the Union thing, I find fascinating, especially for divorced couples where, yeah, like I admire their candor when they're very, like they know exactly what went wrong, you know, like either they got like too focused on the kids or finances were too, you know, frustrating. And yeah, I think it's just so neat that people are willing to share their story, you know? I mean,
yeah,
at beginning and end.
And also, I mean, full transparency, my parents are actually getting divorced after 44 years of marriage. Wow. And it's not a casualty of the pandemic. It's just what, you know, something that happened. And it's interesting promoting a book and like having that in the back of your head. But anyway, you know, my husband, this has been a lot obviously to process. And my husband was, and I were talking through it one day and he said, you know, there really are no bad divorces. You know, like there are bad marriages, but like when you get out of a marriage that you need to be out of, like, this is a good thing. This is a, and it's very strange to like frame divorce as a good thing, but it's progress, you know, like even if it's rooted in stuff that like really messed you up and like there's a way out and the way out is sometimes very much the correct way to go. So.
And that is sort of a fascinating coda to, you know, because I think also, you know, you speak in the book about how, you know, so many of the best marriages are ones where there was a focus on the marriage, not the wedding, you know, and I find that to be a recurring theme. Like, for example, that couple that they get married like on Fifth Ave and she wears go-go boots like in front of, you know, like, but they actually seem to like have it right, you know, which is sort of.
They're actually married. They're still married. I mean, yeah.
Also, Michael McElroy has told us the album by U2 was How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb. Yes. Was that it? 2004, 2005-ish?
I think so. Thank you. And actually, that was, really that would that be one. My husband. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I feel like we should leave it there. How sweet. Like a gentleman named Michael McElroy. I think he's flirting with you. Okay. Oh my gosh. Well, this has been such a blast. Kate, is there anything else you want to talk about or share with us or?
Oh my gosh. I'm just so grateful for everybody's support. And I wish I could see all of your faces and blow you all a big kiss. Thank you so much for being here. I don't know. I don't have anything else to say about this book that
I'm sure it's a lot to like write the whole thing, be in the thick of the whole thing, and then walk away for a little bit and then promote the whole thing. You know, I mean,
yeah, it is. But I'm, you know, beyond grateful to have this experience. So, and Selena, thank you so much for being so awesome and jumping in and like,
oh my gosh, thank you for
reading
the book
in the first place.
And... oh, what a blast. I mean, this is the first book I've ever had sent to me because of my NYT Vows account. And I was like, you know, like, am I an influencer? Not really. So two things before we go. One, book can be purchased at a link in the chat. And two, there are also signed book plates available, which are super rad. So that's all right there in the chat. And gosh, this has been such a fun conversation. This is really
great.
Thank you. I mean, on your big day. And I know your book tour continues. So you have stuff tomorrow and the next couple days, right?
Tomorrow, I will be speaking virtually at Parnassus Bookstore in Nashville. It's Ann Patchett's place, which I'm so excited about. Thursday will be at Quail Ridge Books, which is my hometown Raleigh bookstore that I've been going to since I was 10. So I'm just beyond excited to do that. On May 20th, I'll be speaking at the Harvard Bookstore, not Harvard University, but Harvard, like in like, you know.
Harvard, Mass. Yeah, Western Massachusetts.
No. The one in Cambridge. It's the one in Harvard Square.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I know that one too.
Yeah, that one. And then, is that it? Yes, that's it. It's a lot.
That's great.
But I will say, but one thing I want to say, like, if there aren't any more signed book plates and you would like one, please, you know, send me your address and I would be more than happy to put one in the mail for anybody who wants one. I would be thrilled, in fact.
That's great. And Kate, you're on Twitter and Instagram and it's Kate Doty, CateDoty.
Oh, and my website is katedoty.com. So you can get to that way too.
Okay. Excellent. Okay. Awesome. Right. Well, thank you so much to the Free Library of Philadelphia and to Laura Kovacs for, you know, setting all this up.
And yes.
Thank you so much for having me and congrats on this. It's absolutely wonderful. And it's, you know, wedding season is upon us and this is such a fun read and fascinating and really lovely. So thank you for sharing it with me.
Thank you. And thank you to everybody who's here. It means more to me than I can say. Thank you.
All right. Good night, everybody. Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit, and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.